Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and on yesterday's show, we met two people from a group called More in Common, just begun last year, with a mission to build societies that are more resistant to polarization and social division. They've just come out with a major survey of people in the U.S. called Hidden Tribes, a study of America's polarized landscapes. It frames some politically defined groups of Americans that will be familiar to you, and an additional major one that they call the exhausted majority. Their national survey concluded that about two-thirds of Americans are alienated from the polarized debate and make up an exhausted majority. According to the survey's typology, the exhausted majority includes traditional liberals, moderates, a group they call passive liberals, and a full quarter of the country that is politically disengaged. We also heard yesterday from three callers who seemed to identify with some of the characteristics of being in this exhausted majority. Those three callers all agreed yesterday to join us again this morning for a follow-up conversation, kind of a mini focus group on breaking out of polarized gridlock. And they'll be on in just a minute. First, or a few minutes. First, let's welcome back our two guests from More in Common and their report called Hidden Tribes. Miriam Juan Torres, senior researcher of the Hidden Tribes Survey, and Daniel Yudkin, Associate Director of Research. Thank you both for joining us again for a second day. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, our pleasure.
Thank you for having us again.
And before we bring yesterday's callers back on, let's spend a few minutes defining these groups who make up the two-thirds of Americans you call the exhausted majority. You count 11% of the country to be traditional liberals and another 15% to be a group called passive liberals. What are some of the differences between a traditional liberal and a passive liberal?
Right. So these are two groups that fall on the liberal side. They tend to have liberal views. But on the case of the passive liberals, there's more nuance and they're less committed to the liberal views, I would say. They oftentimes describe themselves actually as moderates or falling into one side or the other. But what really also defines the passive liberals, in contrast to the traditional liberals, is the fact that actually the passive liberals are way more distrustful and less active. So the traditional liberal distinguish themselves from the progressive activist in that the progressive activists are more intense, much less ideologically flexible, and way more committed to their views.
So both those groups, the passive liberals and the traditional liberals, are in this exhaustive majority that you define, but the progressive activists are not. That's another 8% of the country as you count, and they're among the polarized. They're not part of this exhausted majority, right?
Correct. So to provide an example, on immigration, the traditional liberals tend to believe that immigration is good for the country, that immigrants are good, that they contribute. But there are some issues in which they are unsure. For example, when it comes to deporting immigrants who have committed crimes. In having conversations with them in the in-depth interviews, they would tell me, I'm not sure. I understand the arguments on both sides. In general, progressive activists would actually just follow one line and are less flexible and less nuanced on these kind of questions.
Mm-hmm. And also, as part of this two-thirds of the country you call the exhausted majority, you have moderates, who you see as 15% of all Americans. And your biggest single group, the politically disengaged, you call them, more than a quarter of the whole country at 26%. Daniel, who are the politically disengaged?
The politically disengaged is a group, as you say, that constitutes the largest of the seven tribes. And the politically disengaged tend to consider politics as something that really doesn't concern them. They almost see the political game as something that is, not really having to do with their day-to-day life. These people are often far more concerned with the day-to-day difficulties of living, paying the bills, taking care of kids, taking care of their parents. And so what you have with the politically disengaged are people that are tend to be lower income. They tend to be maybe lower education than the other groups than average. And they just tend to be a little bit more suspicious and distrustful of politicians in general. They also tend to be a little bit more prone to conspiracy theory. So these are people that are tend to think that, for instance, shadowy groups may be in controls of the levers of power, things like that. And so there's a tendency for this group in particular to not really subscribe and not really feel as though they're represented by anything, any aspect of the political situation in America.
Can I ask how white or black or other is that politically disengaged group?
Yeah, the politically disengaged group, I believe the politically disengaged group is about 20% African-American or Hispanic, which in contrast to the rest of our group, they tended to be more minority groups than particularly the people in the wings. The wings were far more likely to be white, and the people in the passive liberals and the politically disengaged were more likely to be ethnic minorities.
Uh-huh. And so kind of to that point, Miriam, David Brooks wrote a column, maybe some of our listeners saw it, praising your report, and concluded that the real polarized groups in American politics, the progressive activists and the devoted conservatives, you call those groups, comprise a rich white civil war. These are the ones who get most of the media attention, and David Brooks takes from your report that both sides tend to be affluent and tend to be white. Do you like David Brooks' framing of your results?
I think it's a good assessment of what we found in our survey. So the segmentation, the tribes are not identified based on any demographic characteristics. When we do the segments, the clustering, we don't include those variables. However, once we have identified the different tribes, we do see the demographic trends within those groups. And it was interesting to find that actually like the wing groups are overwhelmingly white and more likely to actually be affluent than other groups. That doesn't mean that everyone who's a progressive activist or devoted conservative is rich, but it's more likely than the average of the population and the other segments. Yeah.
So tell us more, Miriam, about where African-Americans and Latinos fit into these seven political groups, because so much of our political polarization is around race and racism as it pertains to Black Americans and Latinx Americans, even more openly in the Trump era than the past, right? That it's not just rich white Americans who I think of as being the most affected on what you might call the liberal side. So how do you account for the central issue of race in your study? How do Black and Latinx Americans distribute in some more detail among the groups as you've defined them and why?
Right. So as Daniel was mentioning earlier, the passive liberals and the politically disengaged are the groups that encompass more ethnic or race diversity. When it comes to the segments, as I was saying, or the tribes, like they're not based on the race, but it's true that we have identified those patterns. And the majority of the population in all of the tribes said that racism was a problem, but was a problem in the country, including the devoted conservatives and the traditional conservatives. But the way of going about it was actually different for them. And as mentioning earlier, like they're concentrated in these two groups that don't necessarily fall liberal. And they're also in the moderates, there's a part of them that are also ethnic minorities, but it's mainly on those two groups.
You know, there's an interesting finding in the local news that might reflect some of that too, with the Amazon offices in Queens, such a flashpoint for protest right now. Quinnipiac did a poll and found that African Americans and Hispanics are more supportive of Amazon's Queens move than whites. So according to analysis in Cranes, that's probably an indication of the rapid increase in white New Yorkers who embrace progressive causes, while other groups are more focused on jobs and economic growth. I'm not sure everyone would interpret it the same way, but that's one takeaway from Cranes. Seems like it's consistent with your national poll.
Yeah, I think that you know, people often tend to assume that people of color are going to be uniformly on the left-hand side. But the reality is that it's far more complex than that. We found people in the moderate groups and even in the conservative groups who fit those categories. And I think that in general just seems to paint a more complex picture of what people believe and what sorts of policies they're advocating for.
But another thing I think we can take away from your survey is that conservatives are overwhelmingly polarized. Liberals are not. So you have this 8% of the country you call progressive activists on one polarized end of the spectrum. We were talking about them. But also a whole quarter of the country who you call traditional conservatives and devoted conservatives not in your exhausted majority middle. They're at war politically on the other side. But this big majority, you call the exhausted majority, who doesn't really like the political war footing, includes traditional liberals and passive liberals, as well as moderates and the politically disengaged, as you've been describing. So by these categories, most liberals are part of a big group that wants to depolarize, but most conservatives are not. Is that fair to conclude?
To a certain extent, it's also true that when it comes to the moderates and the politically disengaged, there's actually a lot of people in those groups that hold conservative views. So there's a lot of conservatives who actually fall within the exhausted majority, but not in one of the groups that we've called traditional conservatives or devoted conservatives.
Yeah, also, I'll just add to that. One of the main differences here is that we don't, so on the left, you have these sorts of, there's the traditional liberals, which are second to the left, and the traditional conservatives, which are second to the right. Now, we categorize the traditional liberals as part of the exhausted majority, because these are people that are willing and interested in compromise. On the other hand, the traditional conservatives, they don't fall in the exhausted majority, partly because they're pretty happy with the way things are going right now. They aren't exhausted, and they aren't necessarily sort of looking for an opportunity to compromise. They think that we need to defeat the evil within our country rather than finding or healing as a country. And so that particular group, the traditional conservatives, they aren't as extreme as the devoted conservatives, which are on the far right. But again, they don't have the sort of flexible views and the desire for compromise that we typically want to see and look for when we're talking about the exhausted majority.
My guests are Daniel Yudkin and Miriam Juan Torres, co-authors with some other people of this study called Hidden Tribes, a study of America's polarized landscapes. And with all of that from your national survey as background, now let's bring back two of the callers from yesterday who seem to identify with some of your exhausted majority ideas. We have Jose in Queens, who told us yesterday he has a mix of views and says his political ideology is not central to who he is. And Bill in Montclair, who's fed up with politics and hasn't voted in a decade. The third caller, Katie from yesterday, we haven't been able to reach, unfortunately. But Bill and Jose, welcome back to WNYC. We're so grateful to the two of you for donating some more time to this.
Mm-hmm. Right, thanks, Brian.
And thank you very much, Brian.
And I'm just curious to give you each first a little bit of an open platform to say anything your call yesterday got you thinking about overnight, and any reaction to the seven political categories that our guests have just described in some more detail, and if any of them seem to describe you. Jose, you want to start?
Sure. Well, obviously, it got me thinking to a whole array of issues, and like, for example, the Amazon thing. I'm in Astoria, so it's right next to next neighborhood. I'm for it. You know, I think New York is the most competitive city in the world, and I think it'll bode well. I don't agree with how de Blasio and Cuomo bent over for them, but essentially I'm for it. But I always think, what can I do? This is probably the most political thing I've done other than vote, but what can I do to push some sort of efforts? Education and healthcare come to mind are the two main issues, and mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe I could pick one, do something once a month, a quarter, I don't know, but certainly I'm for getting things better, doing things better on the education front, and certainly healthcare as well.
Jose, thank you for starting that off. Bill, what are you thinking?
Well, just following up on Jose there, the generally spending more money on education and healthcare, I think, is extremely important. But just listening to the classifications almost and the subsections or of what is considered to be liberal, mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever thought of myself as anything more than just blanket. Maybe my views are more liberal, but listening to your speakers, it seems like perhaps I'm falling more into a traditional liberal, or I would label myself as more traditionally liberal, which surprises me. But then I think the other designation was this politically disenfranchised, it was a different term, but politically.
That's right.
I think I fall into that category, and I actually think it's interesting that if those categories are accurate, then given my demographics and my race, it may be a little surprising. It's a little surprising to me.
So, Daniel and Miriam, I see you came with a few questions. to ask Bill and Jose to help them see more clearly which group they fit into, and we'll use that to maybe help all the listeners understand how to go forward constructively in our polarized country. So would you like to lead here for a few minutes and ask our caller guests these questions?
Sure, yeah. So what we have basically are some of the core questions that we use to talk to people. These were questions that we asked in focus groups and interviews over the course of our survey, and we found that they are some of the most questions that really get to the core of people's philosophies and beliefs about, not just about like, okay, should we build a wall and should we have gun control, things like that, but more basic, their moral values and their views about life. So we thought that it might be interesting to talk about these things and get your views on them. So so one question, for instance, that we thought was quite interesting, I'm going to read the question and then we can talk about it. So the question is, which statement do you agree with more? People, then there's A, people are largely responsible for their own outcomes in life, and B, people's outcomes in life are determined largely by forces outside of their control. So, Jose, do you want to start?
Sure. I think people are responsible for their own outcomes in life, but certainly it's not with the help of anybody, with the help of someone. Someone needs help along the lines, but I would agree more towards the A, that people tend to do more for themselves, essentially, as opposed to getting help from everyone else.
And I remember you saying yesterday that that was something that fit your own experience in life. You had mentioned that this was something that really spoke to you. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. In my circumstance, my background, my heritage is Mexican. My father is from Mexico. My mother is American Mexican, and we grew up in small town Libertyville, Illinois. And thank God for a great education system there that I was able to know that reading was the bottom line and how you get ahead in life. And just by the process of reading diligently and just staying on the on that track, everything else kind of seemed to fall in place. Certainly being proactive once you get an adult of other things and trying to find your path and your way on what value you can bring to society. It's of course, everyone has those struggles as well, but I think for the most part, that's my background, is what really helped me along is my early education and to read all the time.
Awesome.
So that's
thank
where
you
I come from. And
yeah. Thank you so much, Bill. Jose. Yeah, yeah. Bill. What about you?
God, I listened to those two questions, and where do I, if I would choose A or B, I find that my answer would be straight down the middle.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, so I think that my background is that I have been given by my parents, was given an incredible advantage in education, and I benefited incredibly from that. And then I'm certain that I or anybody could have taken those advantages and, let's say, squandered them. Or you could stay the straight and narrow and work hard, which I think I have also done. So without the advantages that I was given initially, I don't think that it would have been possible for all the hard work, and even if I were straight and narrow, let's say, for that to have proven successful for me.
Right. Bill, I mean, Daniel and Miriam, you want to do one more from your list real quick for time purposes,
yeah,
and then we'll take a break and all of us will kind of interpret some big picture, results from this.
Right. So another question that we ask in our survey is whether what do you think is most important for children to have, either obedience or self-reliance? Bill, maybe you want to start here?
Obedience or self-reliance? You mean obedience to their parents and teachers and caregivers, or self-reliance so that in the sense that they are taught self-reliance?
Yeah, so what are the characteristics that you would prioritize in a child?
I would say self-reliance. I would say teaching them to be able to, depend on other people, but not rely on other people.
What about you, Jose?
I'd go with self-reliance. I think it's important to teach your kids to figure it out, essentially, you know, certainly with some guidance, but I think eventually figuring it out teaches you more than abide by rules all the time, which can constrain some kids. And growing up, I would want them to have the ability to have autonomy and just rely on your own instinct and rely on what feels right and what's good or to do good, essentially.
Stay there, both of you. We have to take a short break. We'll finish this up in a minute and put it into as large a national context as we possibly can. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we wrap up our little two-day experiment with Miriam Juan Torres and Daniel Yudkin from the group More in Common, and their national survey, Hidden Tribes, a Study of America's Polarized Landscape, and Bill from Montclair and Jose from Astoria on as callers for the second day, for which we're extremely appreciative. Unfortunately, the third caller, who was supposed to be part of this little focus group, Katie, who was on yesterday, I guess for whatever reason, couldn't or whatever, didn't join us. Katie, are you there? We have a few minutes left. Katie, call in. 212-433-9692. Okay, but now comes the reveal. Dan and Miriam, you're going to, based on the conversations we've had over 2 days, you're going to tell Jose and Bill which of the seven political tribes you think they fall into.
Using our powers of magic here.
Yes.
We're mind readers.
Right.
Very scientific.
So, right, Bill, you were mentioning that you think you're a bit that given, or maybe it was Jose, I don't know,
like
given
Bill.
The demographic characteristics, it could be surprising. So the two questions that we posed to you guys today are actually an example of the fact that the questions that help us identify the tribes are actually not demographic questions. They're questions based on worldviews and in core beliefs. And Daniel and I quickly talked about where we think you guys fall. And we believe that actually, Jose, you're probably a traditional liberal. And Bill, you're actually a passive liberal. Given the fact that you haven't voted, but passive liberals as well, like they usually tend to define themselves as someone who fall not necessarily middle of the road, but on the one side on some issues and on the other side on others. But yeah, Daniel, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, Bill, it sounded like you are conflicted. You were speaking yesterday about how you resonate with some issues on the right, some issues on the left. At the same time, you also feel disengaged from the political process. So as you were saying, I think that there, but then also, you know, you were talking about some issues in which you felt as though you kind of feel in the middle of the road with regards to how much control you have over your own situation in life. So we thought that you might fit with the passive liberal camp.
And do Jose real quick, because I want to have a couple of minutes for the bigger picture takeaways.
Yeah. Jose, you were talking about healthcare, you were talking about education. These are issues that you feel like are important to you, which are definitely issues that are much more important to people on the left. At the same time, you felt as though that you had more control over the way that your life turned out, which suggests to us that maybe you're not as far on the left as maybe a progressive activist, which and ultimately leads us to think you're a traditional liberal. Although we should say again that this is, you know, after a 5-minute conversation, we'd love to have an hour-long conversation about
just to quickly add to that, if you're actually curious about where you fall, you can actually take a very short survey on our website that will tell you what segment you believe you belong to.
So if they are members, thank you both so much. And in either of those groups, they would be members of the 2/3 of the country that falls into your not so polarized majority. So
correct.
How can we all learn from this to move toward your larger goal of a country that is more resistant to polarization and social division?
Right. The first step is actually a recognition of the fact that these people actually exist. I think that media in the media and social media as well, like the voices that we often hear are actually the ones of the wing segments. But as you were pointing out, Brian, 2/3 of the country are actually belonging to this exhausted majority.
Yeah. And so this opportunity, hearing from people like you, hearing from callers like you, the people who maybe don't have a voice so often in traditional media, or whose voices aren't necessarily heard so much on social media, that is the first step to creating an awareness among this exhausted majority that you're not alone, that there are people that are like you. And that is the next, that then you can build an opportunity to see each other and then build a movement based on that.
So the Bill and Jose party is about to form somewhere between Astoria and Montclair.
That's right.
Bill and Jose.
Somewhere, right?
What's that?
Maybe in the East River somewhere.
Maybe in the East River or the Hudson River. Thank you both so much for participating in this. We really appreciate you engaging.
Thank you all. Very, very, very informative. Thank you.
Thank you.
And so in our last minute, Dan and Miriam, how can people get more information about your group, More in Common, or take your online self-test? Because listeners, you too can figure out which of these political tribes you fall into. How can people take that?
Right. So you can find more about our organization at moreincommon.com. But you can actually find the report and also where to take the survey at hiddentribes.us.
Couldn't have said it better.
So we've got about a minute left. I wonder how big a problem congressional districting is and how big a barrier to what you're trying to achieve. Because even if 2/3 of the country were to agree with, you know, the way you've laid out who we are as a nation and what we believe in, the districting seems to result in a more polarized Congress that's not representative of 2/3 of all Americans being in this, what you call the exhausted majority, that's not interested in polarization.
Right. So, you know, our survey is about Americans' beliefs, what they want. It doesn't necessarily tap into the political reality. And so I assume that a lot of listeners may be hearing this and saying, well, this is all well and good, but when it comes to actual politics in Washington, D.C., or in various states, it's just not the same, not like that. And I agree. I think that there's a lot of, there's been extensively documented gerrymandering, there's power dynamics that really don't end up reflecting the will of the people. And that may be a next step towards addressing that. So knowing the problem and seeing that there's an opportunity for people to agree is the first step towards combating that.
Daniel Yudkin, Associate Director of Research, and Marian Juan Torres, Senior Researcher of the Hidden Tribe Survey, a study of America's polarized landscapes. Thank you so much for a fascinating 2-day visit.
Thank you, Brian.
And have a great weekend, everyone. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.